from zero to money. We unveil the trials and successes SaaS business founders have faced when starting their own businesses. Stay tuned to learn from the ideas that can inspire and change you. Enjoyed the show? Don't forget to subscribe so you won't miss our new episodes. If you're interested in learning more about Xaar's managed technology services, come visit us at xaar.net. That's ZSAH.net.
Welcome to the Xaar SaaS Leadership Podcast, a show where we explore with SaaS leaders what they do to stay on top of their game and share top tips for other SaaS entrepreneurs. My name is David McQueen, and I am the host of this podcast. Our guest today is Emily Forbes, the CEO of CNIT. Now, CNIT is a video crowdsourcing platform enabling some of the largest organizations around the world to scale the way that they produce their video by engaging their own employees, their most valuable assets, to become their storytellers and content creators. And CNIT today works with customers such as Spotify, Novartis, Amazon, Vodafone, and many others to enable them to create engaging user-generated video content from anyone, anywhere in the world. With a background in documentary and production, Emily founded CNIT with a mission to humanize and grow businesses through the power of community and authentic storytelling. Welcome to the show, Emily.
Thank you very much and very good to be here.
Good, good. Glad to have you here. So I always start these podcasts by not focusing on just the business stuff, because everybody talks about business and we know what we do. Yeah. But I want you to be able to tell our listeners something about yourself, preferably legal, that people or our listeners may not know about you. So something about you that our listeners may not know. Go for it.
So my first job actually was working in a fossil shop. So I sold fossils. And a real passion of mine, it grew into a massive passion of mine to the point where actually every kind of payday or paycheck that I would get, I'd just go straight back into the shop. So over about a year and a half, I've built up what I would think is a fairly impressive fossil connection that I continue to add to anywhere that I travel or anywhere I visit or go. So yeah, that's something that people probably don't know and not maybe the most usual start to a SaaS career.
Oh, that's brilliant. I'm just going to ask one more question around it. Where did that curiosity start from? I'm fascinated by that.
I think I've always been passionate about adventure and travel and history. And I just find it so extraordinary that these creatures are fossilized in these rocks from not just sort of thousands of years ago, but millions of years ago. And they're things that you can collect and keep and admire. And it's just like a whole nother world to me. And I think that sparks creativity and imagination. And I just love it.
Absolutely love that. That's fascinating. That's got me big. That was not the journey where I expected us to go. So thank you very much. Really appreciate that. Okay, so as we go through these questions, there's some general questions that I ask most of my guests. I just want to be able to have you to feel as comfortable to share as much as you want and you feel comfortable with. So the first question I'm going to ask you is, what was holding you back, if anything, from becoming a successful business person when you first started out, and how did you manage to overcome it?
So I think as you mentioned at the start of the podcast, my background is in documentary and film. So it's not in tech, it's not in product, it's not in even, you know, software as a service. So I think that the biggest thing holding me back was I had this idea, I had this kind of ambition, and, you know, what I cared about is collaborative and authentic and inclusive storytelling and you know, the fact that content can now be captured on a mobile anywhere in the world, which opens up the kind of whole production landscape. So that was what excited me. The kind of, I guess, way to scale that and make that as big as possible and take it global was technology, which was quite a fundamental part of it that I didn't have experience in. So I guess the piece that was holding me back was, where do I start? I don't know how to code. What does good code look like? How do I even take that step to make this idea now start to be a reality?
Okay, fabulous, fabulous. And the biggest way for you to be able to overcome that, how are you able to do that? Obviously, you knew that there's tensions.
The way I overcame it was first by making a mistake, actually a number of mistakes, but one big one. I immediately went to look at a really cost effective way to build the initial concept, which was outsourcing. But with no background in technology, I didn't really know where to start. So I didn't know how to properly prototype. I didn't know how to properly direct a development team. So I actually ended up spending some of the savings I had on that, which was then wasted. And in the end, hired a developer to work closely with me who kind of bought into the vision, knew where I wanted to take it. And we worked a lot closer as a kind of partnership rather than outsourcing it to a team that I didn't know with the experience that I had.
Okay, good. Good lessons there. Definitely good lessons. So tell us the best business advice you received then. What's the best kind of like essence of business advice that you've received?
So there's one bit of business advice I received recently, actually, which I really liked. Didn't 100% agree with, but it got me thinking very differently. And that was someone said, I don't know why you have a sales team. The best tech businesses, the best product businesses, they shouldn't need a sales team because it should sell itself through referrals, word of mouth, and it should scale that way. So I was kind of pitching that, you know, I wanted to expand the sales team and that's how to grow the business. Even though I believe you'll always need an element of a sales team. I really liked the bit of advice because it pushed me to think about sales very differently. And sales needs to happen across the business. It needs to happen within the product through upsell. It needs to happen with your customers through referrals. And actually, if you did remove the sales team, can your business still grow? And it should be able to. So I like that kind of pressure on not relying on just a sales team to grow your business. I quite liked thinking about it a bit differently because traditionally you would think a sales team is how you grow your business, but I actually think it's across departments.
Okay, fabulous. And obviously, as we like to talk about technology on this show as well, I'd love to know what the best bit of technology advice that you actually received was.
So the best bit of technology advice has actually come from within our team. I, as mentioned, you know, not being from a SaaS, not being from a technology background, have hired in an incredible team, an incredible leadership team who do know SaaS and do have that background. And as they came into the business, started to see, okay, well, how is this team's platforms and technology and data being fed into this team? And how are you really building the engine of this business? What technology are you using to do that? And by having, you know, Dan, who's VP of customer success, coming from like pure SaaS background, I have, you know, George, who's leading our product and marketing from a very scalable consumer background, and Ian, who's our VP of engineering, who came from big corporate business. Together, they were actually able to help advise how we should structure this engine of the company that really has now turned us into not only a product-led business, but also a data-led business.
Okay, so those are the easier ones. Those are the easier questions. Now I go for the bit that's a bit more of a challenge. And again, just I want you to feel comfortable in being able to share what you can here and don't feel under too much pressure. But what would you think was the one of the worst decisions you made for the business, or a bad decision? It doesn't have to be the worst. It can be a really bad decision that you think happened. And why do you think that was?
This is such a good question. A lot of the time, bad decisions turn into really brilliant learnings. But one that stuck out to me, or one that sticks out to me, I guess, if I think back, is we closed a round of funding, and it was quite a large round, and it took quite a long time. And I was so exhausted by the time we closed the round. I was completely kind of, I think, bashed and broken, as a lot of founders are. But rather than stop and take a break and reflect and think about the next phase, now that we had cash in the bank, maybe even take a holiday, or at least go with the leadership team and really get some strategic thinking in place, I just kind of hit the ground running and carried on going at the same speed. Yeah. And I think there was probably an element of burnout, which can then have a knock on strategy, a knock on, we expanded very fast. We hired very quickly, probably without the right processes in place. And that did have a real kind of knock on the business, and we had to then rectify it and correct things over the kind of 6 to 12 months, actually. So I think that was the biggest mistake, not taking time to stop, pause, recoup, re-energize before running at 100 miles an hour again.
Yeah. It's interesting. There are a lot of people who are, so just as an aside, I've done a lot of pitch coaching for organizations, and I say to them, look, you need to understand this is going to be a long journey. And when you are at the end of the journey, you need some space to actually breathe before you go into the next step. People are like, nah, sleep is for suckers. I'll get there. And then they get to the point and they're like, Dave, you know what? You were actually correct. But it's really good that you are able to be one of those founders who are quite open about that and being able to share what you learned from that as well. So on that, in that, using that same kind of energy, if I can, was there anything, were there any like tough or bad decisions you made around technology as well?
Yes, I think a different time. When I first started out, we initially, I mean, almost actually quite quickly, were winning new customers. And these customers were big, large, you know, 250,000 people businesses. And we were about a team of five at the time. And someone gave me actually some bad advice, I thought, which was, well, if these big businesses really want certain functionality in the roadmap, if they can pay you extra, you can then build it for them and then sell it to other people down the line because it's in your product. The biggest mistake on that is you actually start, if you take money from a single customer to build some functionality, that is then bespoke to them. And it should be because they've paid for it, which then means it's not going to be quite the right fit for your other customers. It also then means as you scale out your product, you're starting to have kind of bespoke bits of functionality for different customers, which can prohibit scale. So we then had to completely re-engineer the platform, kind of, you know, really talk very frankly and openly to our customers around how we're going to have to remove certain functionality now, because otherwise we're just not going to be able to scale to the way that we want, or the kind of, you know, the size that we want. And that was really tough because I had to, you know, re-engineer, refactor code. It sunk time, it sunk cost. And up front, what you think you're doing is something quite smart by taking money for builds and you know, development resource. But actually, it only caused issues later.
Okay, that's a really powerful lesson in that. What do you think's the most or the best bit of advice, if I can flip that over? So what would you think was the best bit of advice that you've received? I know you're learning from that specific lesson, but what do you think is the best bit of advice that you've received around technology that specifically points to things like cost savings, revenue, or innovation? What's the best kind of advice that you've received?
I think it's really important when you're building technology to make sure that you are building in an agile way, that you can toggle features and functionality on and off, that you can integrate with other partners. And by doing that, it means you can upsell, that you can grow with existing customers. I mean, we were building a product that really just had one pricing tier because of the way that it was engineered. We couldn't turn functionality on and off. And so now when we've re-engineered it, we've had to put that right at the kind of core of everything that we're doing so that it is as agile as possible and we can service smaller businesses, enterprise businesses, or smaller teams, larger corporates. So I think that's probably the best advice, is to make sure that you have flexibility in the product that you're building, because also then you're going to have the best flexibility in your pricing model and the way that you can actually have a value added pricing model for customers and not try and do a one size fits all, which isn't going to work.
That's fabulous. Fabulous. I'm going to go slightly off track now. I know I kind of like had this, but one of the things I would love to ask is just as a slight addendum to that, is, how, in terms of your actual process, how easy was it to kind of think about what that pricing model looked like?
So initially, when I first sort of started, the methodology around our pricing was, well, this is how much it would cost you to produce a traditional video with a camera crew. Therefore, I'm going to look at how we can reduce that through this technology platform. I think where now our pricing has evolved is actually looking at how are people using SaaS tools? What do people expect? Freemium, you know, your first entry level tier, what are the barriers you can put in? What are the upsell triggers you can put in to kind of lift people, you know, higher on the upsell journey in your product? So more than looking at what almost the industry that we're disrupting and how that prices, we're actually having to look at how other technology are pricing themselves in the market, other SaaS tools are pricing themselves, whether they're in our space or not, because it's now what people are expecting to pay for. And then we're having to bucket different pieces of functionality. And, you know, we're reviewing our pricing all the time. I don't think we'll ever get to a point where like, that's it, that's done and we stop. And we involve our customers in it too. So we'll ask them, what would, you know, what would, what's essential for you in the platform? Now, we wouldn't say to them, help us price it, but we'd ask certain questions to understand what's essential for them to have in the platform functionality wise, what's nice to have. And we can ask different customers that as well, customers that are smaller. So ask them what's essential. Obviously, then you have the big enterprises and you can start to bucket tiers. And now we're actually testing it as well. So there's a whole new pricing model we're about to roll out. So it's a very live conversation for us at the moment. But we've involved our customers in it very much from the beginning.
Thank you. I know I went off on the track then, but it's just brilliant. I think a lot of listeners will benefit from that as well.
I think one of the things is it's all about the, you know, value add pricing. And, you know, in sales that there used to be the saying of, oh, a great salesperson can sell ice to an Eskimo. Whereas that just cannot be the case with SaaS, because you'll sign up, you'll then feel duped pretty quickly, and then you'll just churn. You'll cancel the subscription. So everything has to be about value add. In a sales team, it's about selling the right deal upfront to the customer with then ambition to grow that through value added piece of functionality or services. It's not about selling the biggest deal, you know, from the word go. And I think that's a real pivot or a kind of change that we've built in. I think there was definitely a stage where it was kind of sell the biggest, sell the most, as much as you can upfront. Yes. Whereas now we've changed that process, and it's about listening to them, listening to their needs, and making sure our pricing model is as flexible as possible to set them up in the right way, which will then eventually lead to more growth.
Love that. Love that. And that kind of segues through to my next question, because it more or less, my next question was really going to be what is working for you in terms of your sales and your marketing right now? How does that kind of thinking around your model, how does it tie in together?
So I definitely think that sort of value, again, the value add, the value share, value give, has played a really important part in our marketing. Pre-COVID, pre-lockdown, we kind of shifted from turning up at events, big events where you pay, you know, thousands of pounds sometimes. And as a startup, that really hits. You're then sitting in like your booth with your banner and your, I don't know, 2x whatever it is, the logo square, desperately competing for attention of the few brands that are scattered in the crowd. We realized that actually not only is that draining resource, money, effort, time, but it wasn't getting the best results. Mm-hmm. So we kind of flipped it and thought, okay, from a value perspective, what could we give? What could we do? What could we run that would build a much better relationship with our customers? So we shifted and now do, again, when we could meet in person, we would do private exclusive breakfast. We'd rent a private room. We would get a guest speaker, agenda it. We'd invite existing customers, prospects, people we'd never met before but wanted to try and connect with. We'd keep it really small and just have a super candid, off-the-record conversation where people really felt that they could learn from one another. And we'd choose different topics depending on what our customers really wanted to have conversations about. And a lot of it would be us kicking off the conversation and stepping back and then letting our customers and these other big corporates talk amongst themselves. And they then built their networks off the back of it. And that is what started to drive the best conversations and best leads for us. Of course, then when COVID hit, we had to think about it a bit differently. So how could we take it online? And we, again, kept a similar kind of very personal relationship-driven feel. And we got our customers and did kind of coffee with webinars, kept them, again, very small, kept them very candid, very open, and would always make sure there's follow-up material with it as well. Yeah. And the main goal was, what are we giving people off the back of these events? What are we giving people off the back of their 40 minutes that they've joined a session with us? That they can share easily across their business, whether it's an infographic or key takeaways or even a video that we've produced. And again, that has helped us bring in great leads, but also start good conversations, which actually have evolved into much better customers. You know, I mean, I used to do everything, like go and like wait by the water cooler or the like sandwich stand at these events with my business cards and like try and grab as many as you can. And you can fill the pipeline at the top of the funnel, but it doesn't mean you're going to convert to the level that you want. So that has really helped our funnel conversion, thinking almost smaller, thinking more curated and higher value. What can we give back?
Lovely, lovely, lovely. So give us the top three metrics, if you can, that you use to keep on the pulse of the company, just to make sure that you're heading in the right direction.
We have five that we kind of track across the business. The kind of top three, annual recurring revenue. So we track how we're growing that. The second metric, which does sort of lead on to that, is our net recurring revenue. So churn is really important to track. But actually, as we started to change our pricing model and we started to see more growth from existing customers, net recurring revenue is now our primary metric that we track. So with anyone that we do churn, if that happens, how are we growing existing customers to get to the net recurring revenue point so that we are at 100%, over 100% year on year? Yeah. And actually, our VP of customer success always says to me, if your customers aren't buying more from you in the first, really the first 12 months, push it to 18 months, there's something significantly wrong.
Yeah.
They should be incrementally buying more than you and it, from you, and it should be scaling out. So that net recurring revenue is a very, very important metric to us. And the other is a bit more of a different one, but employee engagement.
Yeah.
I think this is a really, especially this year, we've done more pulse surveys. We've had more open door sessions. If you know, anyone can go and talk to anyone in the business anytime. We've wanted to make sure there's as open communication channel as possible, or as open communication channels as possible. Because actually none of these metrics mean anything if the employees aren't engaged and motivated and feeling like the work they do is really making a big impact.
Yes.
So I'd say those are our, there's the ARR, NRR, and our employee engagement. Okay. And of course, then there's looking at our total customers and our customer health score, you know, our LTV to CAC ratio. But if I was to pick the three that have really been kind of front and center for us this year, it would be ARR, NRR, and our employee engagement.
Love that. Love that. I love that piece about the employee engagement. It's come up before as well in a conversation I've had, and I really like that. It's good to see that. So crystal ball time. Okay. You can run with this however you want to, but where do you think the industry is going in the future, say in terms of technology or whatever, in the next 5-10 years or whatever, in the and obviously we're bang in the middle of a flipping pandemic and, you know, everything's been thrown upside down anyway. But, you know, once we kind of, I don't want to say get out of this because God knows what the future is going to be like, but where do you see the industry going?
I think, do you know what, and it's funny when you say like get out of this, or, you know, once this is all over, I don't think any industry is going to go back to the way that it was before this. Mm. Even if you're, you know, COVID positive, or I was even talking to production crews and specifically in our video landscape, user generated is now here to stay. User generated content, crowdsourcing is here to stay. So even broadcast production teams are thinking about how they're going to be bringing that into their future storytelling, even though they will go back to traditional production and film crews. That bit of innovation that they've had to push and had to kind of hit head on won't disappear. And I know that's the same across in industries. Innovation has come through this, no matter how hard you've been hit. I think that the future of user generated, of crowdsourcing your stories, there's going to be a lot more development in AI, and that's a lot down to the content creation piece and the editing piece. So there's an increasing demand for content, an increasing demand, you know, a consumption that's kind of going through the roof. People are becoming more creatively confident. And that's not just, you know, Gen Z on TikTok. We're seeing this across different generations, across different countries, cultures. And more voices are being heard and more content's being produced, but it's the curation piece and I guess the editing piece to make sure that we're telling really high quality, crafted, engaging stories. That's where I think the big development's going to be. And I'm really excited about how we're looking at that within CNET. How can we help our customers tell the most inclusive and impactful stories at scale? And I think as well, linked in with that. I do think that this creative confidence that is now, it's almost actually in a way COVID has educated the world about the importance of user-generated content and the possibilities it can open up way more than our marketing budgets, no matter how much we raised, no matter how much like we put out there could do. And whether it's for CNET or just the video space in general, I think that it's changed how production will come together forever. And user-generated video, user-generated stories that are truly human, truly personal, aren't going anywhere.
Yeah.
But I think it's AI and it's curation and it's editing that is going to be the big development over the next few years.
Fabulous, fabulous. And so my final question. My gosh, I could have sat here and talked to you for ages. Continue. But for my final question, tell us your top three tips for building a successful SaaS company.
So my first one, especially if you're not from a SaaS background, is to hire in the right team, SaaS experience into your team, and do not be afraid. Do not get knocked that they are going to know more than you and they're going to be better at you in that space. But that's exciting because it's only going to push your vision further and you know, further forward. I think the second is the importance of building an agile platform, a platform that can scale to have tiers, feature toggles, integrations, because again, you don't know where you're going to want to scale your platform out to. We started with enterprise. We will be scaling out now to smaller businesses and self-serve. So that flexibility is really important.
Yeah.
And then the third is the effort and input. And it's good that you picked up on pricing, but on value-based pricing.
Yeah.
So making sure that you are thinking value first with every customer conversation that you're having and that your model can reflect that rather than just getting the biggest sales numbers up front.
Okay, that's fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. And again, as I said, just having looked at it, as with all my guests, I go away and I look behind the scenes as to what's actually happened. It's really great to hear it from your voice. And I think those three fabulous tips about hiring the experienced SaaS team, building the agile platform and value-based pricing. I think a lot of people will really benefit from that, and not just the newbies starting in there. I can tell you there are going to be a lot of people who have been in it for a while who are really going to be thinking, oh my God, why didn't I think about that before? So I really, really appreciate your time on this, Emily. It's been fascinating having an insight into how your vision and how you're actually to start this and the vision that you have to take it into the future as well. So thank you very much.